Get to Old Navy now for February's biggest style steal. 40% off all jeans and tees. Jeans start at just $18 for adults, $12 for kids. With tees from just $7 for adults, $6 for kids. All jeans and tees are on sale, even your favorite rock star jeans. All jeans and all tees are 40% off right now. Don't miss out. Run into Old Navy and OldNavy.com today. Valid 211 to 221. Excludes in-store clearance jeans and tees. Active license and men's package tees.
I mean, I remember one time, the very first time I had to prep for a presentation in that lab, I gave it and it was, I could tell partway through, I was like, this is not going well. I'm not nearly as ready as I thought I was. I hate that.
When you're in the middle of something, you're like, oh my God, this, yeah. I'm blowing it.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, it was a practice, right? It was totally a practice run. It was like a week and a half before I had to give the real talk. I had so much time to, like, you know, get it cleaned up. But I walked out of that practice and I was really upset. And when I went and I sat down with my boss or my advisor at the time, I broke down because I was so disappointed in myself. And he was like, this is why we do this. This is the first time you've ever given a talk out of my lab. Like, don't worry. We're going to sit down. We're going to talk through this. And, you know, and in a couple more days, we'll go over it again and it's going to be fine. And it was fine. It went really well. But I needed that dry run to know I wasn't where I thought I was.
This is Wine with Friends. Grab your glasses and get ready to pop that cork. It's time to catch up.
There we go.
Amy. I'm so excited you're here. You have no idea.
Hi, Chris.
So, longtime listeners will know, Sarah and I, in a moment of drunken ridiculousness, decided to name all of our constant listeners winos. And Amy is one of our original winos.
Yes.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, as Chris said, my name's Amy. He and I met in graduate school. I had the pleasure of living with him for several years, and we were in the same PhD program. So we have some history.
A lot of it fucked up, but true story. Very fun history.
Right.
Amy's right. The one who got me capable of drinking more than one beer without being drunk.
It's true. That was all me. You have me to thank for that.
It's absolutely true. There was a point in our relationship when I wanted to buy groceries and our fridge was full of beer. So I just started drinking beer to make room in our fridge.
That's right.
And it legitimately upped my tolerance. You had. Yeah. I think you did some, like, a summer party or something.
Yeah, or I don't know. You know, I was a social person. So.
It's true. That puts it mildly.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to join.
Thanks,
one,
me
just
because
it's been forever since I've seen you.
I know.
So I was excited we were able to hang out and have a sleepover and, yes. And catch up. Veg on TV for a day while you recovered from a wedding.
Yes. Yep. Oops.
Our friend John just got married Friday.
Friday. Yeah, April
27th. And unsurprisingly, when all of our friends got together, it was a bit of a party.
Yes.
So Saturday was largely a recovery day for both of us.
Yeah. Yep.
So yeah, I'm glad you're able to come.
Me too.
So yeah. I've also been very excited to want to initiate a slightly more serious conversation with you because one of the things that I've been wanting to do as a project of this podcast is to just shine a light on chemistry careers that are not what people assume chemistry careers are.
Right.
You know, I've obviously, for obvious reasons, a bit of a personal stake in this one.
Really?
But I was actually really excited to find an opportunity to talk to you. We've been trying to Skype this, but
yeah.
since you're here, I was very excited to do it in person.
Right.
But you work in industry.
I do.
You are an industrial chemist. Mm-hmm. You no longer work at a bench.
That is true.
And I just want to talk a little bit about that. So tell me about your job. What
okay,
do you do?
So my current job is with a veterinary diagnostics company.
What does that mean?
So chances are if you have taken your pet to the vet, they have done a test that my company produces.
Okay.
Whether it's testing your pet for a parasite or for some sort of virus or even just different bloodborne diseases, in addition to things like kidney disease or checking glucose levels, checking on like fructosamine levels, any sort of blood test that your pet might have done diagnostically or just for a well check, chances are it's a test that my company makes. We're the market leader, so we do have a few competitors, but we tend to be where the vets lean.
Okay.
So my role is I'm in the clinical chemistry R&D department.
Okay.
So I work on the development of new products, but I'm not in the lab physically doing the work anymore. Okay. At this point, I am involved in the brainstorming, the data review, all of the meetings that go around getting a new product to the market. And I am in charge of standardizing their verification and validation procedures. So when you bring a new product to the market, you have to obviously validate that it works the way that you say it's going to.
Yeah.
But most of the veterinary field is not regulated like the human market. So there isn't an FDA equivalent. There is the USDA, and that's more for poultry and livestock, less for companion animals. Mm. And I'm on the companion animal side, cats, dogs, even horses.
Emotional support duck.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know that we do much with ducks, but I'm sure there's a test there somewhere. We have to come up with, this is how we're going to prove that our product works, but we don't have anyone setting those regulations for us. So instead of everyone reinventing the wheel with the number of new products that we have coming out, I'm going to standardize that process across the vet lab. It's called the vet lab part. So the stuff that goes into the vet clinics, mm-hmm. I'm going to standardize that process within the company. So it's very different than what I did in graduate school.
Yeah. It's amazing to me sometimes looking at what I know people's PhD research was and looking at what they do now. It almost never matches.
Yeah. I mean, it can, right? It can. And there are the people that are lifetime,
yeah,
you know, microfluidics. People tend to, if you're going microfluidics, some people stay there heavily. Or LCMS, that's one where people stick around. Mm. But,
okay,
you know.
So I have so many questions. Okay. One, because I didn't really actually know what you did.
It's new. I've only been there for like 7 months, so fair that's enough. Legit.
So one of the things you mentioned really – so mm-hmm. I live and breathe the policy space, obviously.
Yep.
So that's the stuff I hone in on usually. And of course. Find it really fascinating that you all have to operate in this market where it kind of sounds like – maybe I'm putting words in your mouth. But it sounds like there are less rules of operation.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess oftentimes in our culture and news reporting and things like that, I think people assume that that's what companies always want. And I find in my experience that's often not the case, because if there's some shared set of rules everyone's operating by, it takes a lot of the ambiguity out of the world.
Uh-huh.
And it may actually often sometimes makes it easier for companies to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish. And I'm sure that that's totally true 51% of the
yeah.
time.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of different ways to look at it. So when you're looking at the human market, it's highly regulated by the FDA,
yeah.
right? When you're putting a new product to the market, regardless of whether it's a medical device or a new drug or even just a container that you plan to sell a drug in, there's a series of testing and maybe even just, you know, clinical studies that have to be done in order for that product to get to the market. And the FDA has everything very defined. But at the same time, that can also be a hindrance, because the cost involved in all of that testing can be really high. And in many cases, it's good information to have, but there are situations where, logically speaking, you would know that all of that testing is not going to give you any more information than what you already have. But because this is how the path is set forward, that is what you have to do. Whereas in our situation, right, we don't have anybody who's spelling out, this is how you prove that your product works. These are the steps that you need to do. This is where you submit it. This is the format that you submit it in. For us, it's all about good science and
yeah.
showing to ourselves, this is how it works. This is what it can do, so that when we put it on the market, we're not getting feedback from vets that's like, what, you know, what's going on with your product? This is not what you told me it would do. So we have the advantage in that we're not tied into one specific way to do it, but we have the disadvantage that we're not tied into one specific way to do it. And so people tend to go off and do their own thing on occasion. And 6 months down the line, you'll be like, well, why did you do it that way? That's not giving us the data that we need.
Yeah.
So there's a balance, you know, there's definitely a part of me that misses that rigid FDA QA, QC requirements, because it was defined and I knew how to follow it. and everyone knew how to follow it. People weren't doing things like forgetting to record their experiments, because you don't forget to record your experiments when you're doing stuff for the FDA,
no.
Right?
That's no.
But at the same time, like, not having to deal with all of that is kind of nice too. It gives me a little more freedom to design a study logically. This is what it makes sense to do. This is how I'm going to get the data that I need. I'm not doing it just because the FDA said this is how I have to do it. So there's pluses and minuses to all of it.
Okay. So I don't have to spend a ton of time on like the mechanics, what your company does. Because what I'm actually really interested in is you no longer work at the bench.
I do not.
And one of the things I've been trying to do a lot of within the chemistry community is highlight that there are a lot of people like us who do real chemistry, who never touch a chemical.
Yeah.
And, you know, it sounds like a lot of the work that you focus on is kind of like the basic blocking and tackling of bringing something to market, where it's not necessarily about the core science, but the process the core science has to go through to get to what you want. And probably it's both.
Yeah, I get to do a little bit of both right now, because the one project that I'm working on is pretty early in the development phase. The formula itself is pretty well set at this point, but there's some tweaking that needs to be done to get the product to work. So it's fun because I get to look at the data and come up with ideas on how are we going to get the precision that we want to make this medically, you know, relevant. Mm-hmm. But I'm not physically the one in the lab developing the assay or, you know, putting it on the slide or running the testing to see what the precision looks like. That's just not my responsibility anymore.
Sure. But there's also these other parts of it, right, that are identifying a market gap or identifying a need that isn't being addressed, figuring out how you can actually, you as a company, could address that in a space, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's not something a space that I'm really in so much right now. There's like, you know, a whole other set of people that figure out what's our next big thing going to be. You know, I'm still learning about the vet field. And so figuring out what's relevant for a vet isn't really something that I'm focusing on. That information gets relayed down to me of, okay, this is where we need to be to make this relevant for a vet. This is how it has to work. And I help get it there.
So this is a very different type of work than what our PhD programs prepared us for. And I guess
it is.
That's what I'm trying to drive toward. It's like, what are the components, from your perspective, having taken this path, what are the components of your education that were exactly, let's start with positives, that were exactly right? Like, what components of your PhD absolutely did prepare you for this job that I don't really think you knew existed when you were in grad school?
I didn't. And what parts didn't it? So definitely right out of graduate school, I would have never been able to go into this role. One, because it's not something that you just do straight out of grad school, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're not just like, okay, now I can be in charge of stuff. Like, you would hope so.
Accurate.
But no, right? That's not how it works. So I think the one thing about my grad school experience is it taught me to be a good thinker, right? It taught me how I had to work through a problem and really just what good science is. And sometimes, you know, you do way more than you need to in graduate school, and it's because somebody's really curious and they want to see what you're doing, or maybe they don't recognize how important your work is until it's too late and you've done way more than maybe you had to do. I think that happened to a lot of us.
Yes.
I believe a lot of us had the comment in our dissertation of more work than necessary to graduate. I definitely saw that more than once. but again, it's a learning experience. You learn how to deal with different people. You learn how to communicate with different audiences, right? So the way that I communicated with my committee was different than the way that I communicated one-on-one with my boss. And you learn how to think. Really, that's what it comes down to, right? Getting a PhD is learning how to think and to learn and to be flexible and to really just develop your skill set as a scientist. You know, I think I am a way more well-rounded scientist and chemist than I would have been even just in my original graduate school lab, because my first lab was so focused on chromatography. Now, don't get me wrong, there are some amazing chromatographers that have come out of that group, and they are really good scientists too. Mm-hmm. But by the time I was coming through, the focus in that group was very different, and I wouldn't have gotten the mentoring there that I got in the group that I graduated from.
Sure.
You know, that was a lot more about like this is what it means to be a good analytical chemist, and this is the way you need to start thinking about things. And just, it also gave me a really thick skin. So,
well, I mean, we laugh about that, but that's actually really critically important, especially in a modern business focused world.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be able to take criticism, whether it's positive or not, or constructive or not, I should say, right? Because criticism is never really positive. But there is such thing as constructive criticism, and then there's stuff that's just hurtful. And you have to be able to take them both and know how to
identify them.
Yes, identify them, know how to handle them, and know what to do with them.
Yeah.
Right? And you also have to understand that just because the work that you did, maybe it didn't work out the way that you had planned, or it wasn't received the way that you had hoped, that isn't a personal thing. Right? I mean, everybody makes mistakes and everyone does things a little bit differently. So being able to understand and handle that sometimes your work isn't what someone was asking for is, I mean, that's a really important thing, because you're not going to make everybody happy. And learning how to handle that is something that not everyone is able to do.
Okay.
So
what are some components of your career in this job? Because this isn't your only job. You've had other jobs and worked in other places.
Right.
What are some components of the work, of the career path that you have chosen that grad school didn't prepare you for?
Well, I think
that it could have. I want to be a little specific about this, because
that it could have.
Yeah. I'm trying to get the ACS, or at least the broader chemical community, to think more about broadening the definition of chemical education.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm trying to give you context. Is that, you know, I've been yelling at them for a long time that I think like an ACS certified degree ought to have presentation or communication classes attached to it.
Oh my gosh.
So like things like that. Those are the types of solutions I'm trying to get to. Like, I think that to get our PhDs, we should have been required to take several courses in communications or public speaking.
Yeah, and I think that I actually really agree with that, because unfortunately not all advisors are really good at grooming their students in that case.
I think
right?
the ones who do are actually quite rare.
Personally. I mean, I think I was really lucky that mine is one of those.
You were.
You know, we didn't go to a conference and give a talk without him seeing it at least twice. You know, and not all advisors do that. You know, there are several advisors that will just let you out the door and do whatever you want to do. And then you're not prepared for your audience. You know, grad students aren't necessarily ready to answer all the questions that they're going to be asked by their advisor's competitor, or, you know, someone in industry who's really interested in their advisor's projects, or, you know, a route that they're taking. And, you see so many bad presentations out there. It's been a while since I've been to a conference, just because of the way that, you know, life has been.
Sure.
But I remember being in presentations where people were still using like all the animation and sounds and like all of the really distracting stuff in PowerPoint, or they weren't capable of making a slide readable, or if they did make it readable, there was only text on it. Yeah. And it's just all these little things,
like
that
400 words of text on the slide.
Lordy, I can read it. Like, just hand me the handout and I'll be on with my way. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely more to it than just going into the lab, doing the science. I mean, being a good writer, being able to publish your own work.
That's a big one.
Isn't something that everyone, you know, not everyone's blessed with an advisor who helps them. Some advisors just do it, right? You write the original paper and it's terrible. The advisor fixes it, submits it, and that's the end of it. Or they let it get submitted terrible. You know, I mean, how many papers have you read when you're like, I can tell that's not a native English speaker who wrote that paper?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you wonder sometimes, how does that happen?
Yeah.
But it obviously does. So those, and I think, again, those are things that I was blessed with. Wonderful, you know, as much as my advisor drove me crazy and there are things that I disagreed with, he did groom me. And he did, if you allowed him to, you came out of that group as a very good scientist and well-groomed for a very strong professional life. You know, the people coming out of that group are successful, and that has a lot to do with the time and the effort that he put into his students. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not he's still currently doing that, I'm unsure. I know that life has gotten very busy. He's accepted a chair position, and, you know, I'd be surprised if he wasn't, but it may not be to the same extent that it, you know, that it once was.
Sure.
And that's what happens, I think, as advisors move on in their career too. Like, the teaching part and the mentoring part sometimes loses its flair. Mm-hmm. Groups that get too big, it gets harder, you know, whatever. But you're right. I was blessed. And that was a lot of how a lot of my success comes from the fact that I can get up in front of a room full of people and talk about what I do. And it's literally just a conversation, you know, like when I present, yes, I get nervous. And I mean, you've seen it. Lots of people in grad school saw it. Like, I mean, I think there were times where people thought I was going to like be sick before I was talking in front of a room. But once I get up there, it's like, you know,
you're on.
I'm on. And that's all there is to it. And I can talk about what I'm doing because I've been taught how to talk about what I'm doing and to be aware of why I'm doing what I'm doing and to tell the story, mm-hmm. you know. I think my first job out of grad school was the only one where I didn't have to give a job talk. But after that, I still had to I interviewed for my current position and I interviewed for a different role that I ultimately ended up not accepting, but I had to give, I had to give hour long presentations for those, which you have to be capable of doing to continue your career, mm-hmm. you know, and you have to there has to be a certain flair to it because at a certain point you stop owning what you're presenting. And so when you have to – even now, right, if I have to go and give a talk because I'm applying for another job, I have to be really careful because everything that I do, I can't just present anywhere. It's all owned by my current company.
Yeah.
And not all of it's cleared for release. You know, with both those job interviews that I did while I was at my first job, I had to find data that had been cleared for release that someone else had presented at a conference and, you know, still try and utilize my grad school data as much as I could, despite the fact that it was, you know, 5+ years after graduating. So stuff stops becoming relevant and you're not as familiar with it anymore. So you can't talk about it as much because I haven't touched it. I mean, I had to reread part of my thesis, right? So I think that's a really good point. I think that not just presentations, but writing and having that be part of your education is important. It was part of mine. I had amazing undergraduate professors who did a great job of teaching me how to write a lab report. I also did 3 summers of undergraduate research. That helps. I started presenting scientific data at 19, 20 years old. You know, it was one of those things. I started making posters that first summer. I had to do a poster. I had to do a talk at the end of that summer. So they've been grooming me since day one, but not everybody gets that. And I saw that when I was teaching at Michigan, you know, people come out of Gen Chem not knowing how to write a lab report. Not sure how I feel about that.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I agree with you. And I think, again, I used this phrase intentionally at the beginning is there's some basic blocking and tackling to any kind of career, you know, mm-hmm. football analogy aside, but it's just there are basic operational skills that are necessary, that are common, whether you're a scientist in a technical mm-hmm. lab or doing policy or managing a company or any of these other things that are connected to the scientific field, that you can be brilliant with the data and the chemicals, but if you can't communicate your results or articulate why it matters or connect it to the broader world, you can't get funding, you can't sell it, you can't apply for grants, mm-hmm. you can't recruit the best minds, you can't sell yourself to investors. There's all of this stuff around the chemical enterprise. And the only thing we ever prepare our people for is this tiny core component mm-hmm. that can't survive in isolation.
Well, and the other thing, and even when you think about people staying in academia, right, you don't really prepare someone to be a professor by sending them to graduate school. Because all of a sudden you're thrown into a professorship. You're not really the one doing the research anymore. You have to run the lab. You have to run the finances. You have to do the teaching. You have to get all of the money. And you were never taught, you didn't have to take an accounting class. You don't know about budgeting and how to handle, you know, a lab environment. And you don't know, you know, if you're going to be a teacher, you have to go through all of these classes to learn how to read people and deal with kids and, you know, elementary school teachers have to also kind of go through counseling courses, right? But as
child psychology, right? Courses.
But if you're going to be a professor, it's like, oh, you got a PhD. That's all you need. But I mean, think about the shit that undergrads have to deal with. Sorry.
We say fuck on this podcast all the time. Don't worry about it.
Well, I know. Anyway. Okay. So think about what you deal with as an undergrad, right? And people who are at big institutions aren't seeing that. Like, professors just aren't understanding that, like, maybe this kid is going through a lot and needs someone to reach out to them. Or even, like, think about graduate students. Like, you know, I mean, the rate of depression and just grad school is hard.
And unhealthy.
Yeah. And if your advisor isn't capable of reading social cues or is awkward and just doesn't know how to address poor situations, like, that can be detrimental to your, like, overall well-being. Mm-hmm. But because they, you know, published 5 papers in Science and they had a postdoc with the, you know, top person in their field, then they're the best candidate for that position as a tenured professor. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make sense. Like, some people are great at it, and the grooming they got in grad school is all that they need. But even, like, even your postdoc doesn't necessarily fully groom you to be a professor. And I just don't know that that's really addressed.
I think that's absolutely true. I think we're at a place where we're finally starting to recognize that we have not, as a community, you and I are both chemists. So we're talking about this from the chemistry perspective, but I really think this is true in almost every scientific field. We are doing a terrible job at creating a self-sustained industry of our own selves.
Well, and I think that we're like, a lot of it has to do with just, one, we're not preparing people, but also the expectations early on are just, they tear you down. I mean, the average postdoc time in the biological sciences is 5+ years.
That's insane.
That's great. I mean, postdocs don't get paid that much.
They really don't.
They're like glorified graduate students, mm-hmm. and they have more responsibility. They get paid a little bit more. Some universities treat them, you know, well enough that they at least get some of the, like, employee benefits. But, like, really, 5+ years, mm-hmm. after you've done 5+ years of graduate school, what are you accomplishing? Yeah. Publish a couple papers and move on with your life. Yeah. Like, I just can't imagine that you're getting that much out of that long of a postdoc. And some people do. And we have friends who did it, right? Yeah. We have lots of friends who have had those postdocs that long. We know people who are still postdocs. How that's possible, I don't even know. But it is. And, you know, like, I was talking to one of my friends at work, and she's more on the bio side. And she was saying how they're looking into, like, setting a limit on, like, the length that you can be a postdoc or whatever. And I was like, whoa, when bio is an average of 5 years, and she goes, try 7 to 10. And I was like, whoa, no one I talked to said that. But, like, in her experience, her, you know, people she knows have had 7 to 10 year postdocs. Like,
that's insane.
That's craziness.
It's longer than you took to get your PhD.
It's absolute crazy. I mean, it literally means you're not starting your adult life until you're almost 40.
Yeah.
Right? Because, yeah. I mean, think about it. You're in your late 20s when you finish graduate school, unless, you know, you're a golden child and you do it super fast, because they are out there.
Their 1% does that.
Those people. But then you spend another 10 years as a postdoc. Like, how do you even establish – how do you even ever think about retiring if you're, like, 40 before you start your grown-up job?
I agree.
You know?
So about 4 years ago, I wrote an article about this, and I did a little bit of investigation. There's actually – this is fascinating to me. There's actually an understood economics – field of economics model of this type of employment structure. And it's called a glamour labor market. It's exactly the same as being an actor in Hollywood.
Holy cow.
There's like, think through the mechanics of it. There is a very limited number of positions, mm-hmm. at the top of rung, and they are highly profitable and highly coveted. But there's a glut of people down below who are clawing up there for this very small number of positions.
Right.
And it's the promise of fame and fortune that keeps all of these people wanting these positions. And because of that, the industries that manage this whole system find it cheaper to hire 3 people at the lowest rung rather than 1 person at the middle rung. Yeah. So it's like you create this incentive to have this massively underpaid and oversupplied, mm-hmm. labor force for this very small silver star up at the top.
Right.
It's exactly the same as a Hollywood actor.
Mm-hmm.
And when that was finally explained to me, this light clicked on in my head of, like, holy crap.
Right?
That's really what it's like.
It is.
And this is fundamentally what I have such an objection to with how our profession is structured right now. It's that we're not preparing anyone for the actual careers that they have. And the one career that we tell people is worthwhile is almost impossible to achieve.
Yeah, no, it's especially now. I mean, tenure track positions are just not easy to find. Yeah. And even like, you know, even some of your, I mean, your tier one universities, you already, you have to get a postdoc, you have to do this, you have to do that. Like,
and you have to be do it well at the right place from the right people.
It's all about your pedigree, right?
Absolutely.
Where you came from. I mean, I'm lucky that like I have a great lineage, but you know, if you go to a graduate school that's kind of, you better go to a postdoc that's, you know, top notch.
Yeah.
Or if you go to a grad school that's top notch and then you take a step back for your postdoc, good luck. Mm-hmm. It always has to be a step up each time, yep. Right? I mean that's crazy pants too, especially when you really feel like it should be about what you do. Right? What work
and that's the did story I generate? We tell.
But it's not. But it's about who not. You did it with.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? It's who you worked for. I mean, think about all the professors that we oohed and goggled about when we were in graduate school, right? They worked for people like Grubbs and for Jim Jorgensen. And, you know, it's
Nobel
like
Nobel Prize
you
laureates.
Yeah, you know who the big names were. Like, the big names of Michigan were the people who worked with the big names before them, mm-hmm. Right? Like, you don't. I mean, people do it. They work their way up, and they become a big name. But for the most part, the big names come out of the big name labs.
Yep.
And that's why you have people fighting to work for people like Melanie Sanford and to work for people like Bob Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Because well, they generate the big names. Oh, my gosh. They're wonderful. I mean,
they're wonderful people and wonderful professors, but they're also captured by this system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like all the other professors that are in this. And I just – that fundamentally is my objection to the whole system.
Well, and I think the other thing too that I think about – we're very fortunate in the fact that we went to a graduate school that was incredibly collaborative, right? We didn't go somewhere where the organic chemists had to lock their hoods and professors didn't routinely pin their students against each other. You know, they didn't assign three people the same project and say whoever finishes first graduates – and that happens.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I respect the people who have, you know, been wooed. Other schools have attempted to woo them away from Michigan. And one of their reasons for not leaving is their unwillingness to lose that. You know, when your student can go down the hall and talk to another professor because they're having trouble and you're not there and they need someone to, like, bounce an idea off of and they know that that's okay, that's a big deal. You know, as when other schools are literally having to lock hoods so that students don't get sabotaged and pinning students against each other, when the collaborative environment that we had was incredible. I mean, so we haven't talked about this at all, but I'm a gas chromatographer by trade. And a lot of my friends who are organic chemists would use GCs in their work just to see if they made what they thought they made or how many, you know, how pure their product was. And they, I love them all dearly, but they treated them like machines, which we are not okay with as analytical chemists, and trashed them. But when they were having trouble, their advisors, more often than not, would be like, go talk to Amy. Go ask Amy if she can help you. Like, mm-hmm. You know, these are professors that I interacted with very little, but they knew that I was a GC person. They knew that these people were my friends, and they were like, you know, see what she can do for you. See if she has the tool that you need to fix it. See if she can help you fix it. And not all schools allow that.
Yeah.
So we were just, I don't know, we were really lucky.
Absolutely. Really one of my lucky. PhD chapters was just because someone at the dental school was like, I made this film and it's doing a weird thing and I don't understand what it's doing. And they were like, well, this professor over in the chemistry department works with lasers and surfaces. Go talk to him. And
you got a chapter of it.
I happened to be the person that he saw when he walked in the door to my lab because my desk was right there.
Right.
And a year and a half later, that was my third research chapter of my PhD.
My first chapter is because I thought a geochemistry class sounded like a cool cognate.
And I remember that. You
I went up
that.
To the professor and I was like, hey, I'm learning how to use this really cool piece of instrumentation. Do you have any cool samples that I can run? And he was like, how much time do you have? And that was my whole first chapter. It was like my first 2.5 years of grad school was just because I was like, hey, do you have anything neat that I can put on my instrument? You know, we think about all the crossover professors at Michigan. There are very few professors that are like professor of chemistry. It's usually like professor of chemistry, professor of pharmacology, professor of biochemistry. Like they have like 80 appointments.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it is what it is. But
so I think this is really my point is like our scientific system is structured around a time when chemistry and biology and physics and math and engineering were all easily distinguishable sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't believe that's the case anymore.
Oh, definitely not.
And we're in a new world where new problems require all the interfaces between these expertises, mm-hmm. and our entire system for training the community that tackles these problems is antiquated to 200 years ago, mm-hmm. and we are not doing enough to change it. And for me, that's partly why I want to talk to you. Just like, you know, one of the ways that I think we can break through this barricade is to show the value of people who can cross these bridges,
right,
in spite of the education they've received.
Yeah.
And what are the components that they missed that, had they been prepared for ahead of time, they could have achieved even more now.
Right.
So I'm appreciative that you see it my way.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think about it exactly what you're talking about, like when it comes to presenting and whatnot, because I keep hearing that the reason I was hired into my current job was because of how easy it was for me to get up in front of that room. Mind you, I had to talk about mostly GC work because that is what I was able to talk about and what I had been doing. And 98% of the people in the room that I was talking to weren't chemists who were super familiar with GC. Most of them weren't even chemists. But I was relatable and I showed them a lot of flexibility and ability to learn, right? And it came down to my personality was a good fit, and I clearly showed that I had the willingness and the ability to do what they needed me to do. And not everyone can demonstrate that. It's just, I was lucky.
You were lucky, but you were also prepared.
Well, yeah, but I was lucky that I had an advisor who helped me prepare for that kind of stuff, right?
Yep, and that's the problem. That needs to be the norm.
Yeah.
Well, that's our podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I know that this topic itself may not be one that all of you listeners may find all that sexy or interesting, but this is one that I find personally incredibly important and compelling, and I think it's something we need to talk about more. I think there's a lot of truths that Amy and I covered in this conversation that, quite frankly, apply in more than just the scientific enterprise, but I hope that those of you who are scientists, this challenged your assumptions a little bit and made you think a little more, and hopefully was fun and interesting to boot. Thank you to Amy Porter for joining me. It was so awesome to see and talk with you again, and I can't wait to have you on again. You're an official wino, so welcome to the club. If you want to connect with us on social media, as always, we're on Facebook and Twitter at Wine Friends Pod. Connect with us there. We'd love to hear from you. If any of you winos out there want to come on the show, let us know. We'd love to have more people on and talk about the stories and interests of your lives. Thanks as always to Lee Rosevier for the music in this episode, and we'll see you next week.